This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. In some places, it can be used to treat pain or other medical conditions. In others, you can walk into a store and buy it over-the-counter for whatever reason you decide. And yet, thousands of Americans are currently incarcerated for using or distributing it. I'm talking, of course, about marijuana. Now, with so many conflicting narratives around the drug, it's hard for adults to know exactly what to think, never mind what to tell their kids. KJ Dell'Antonia writes the Motherlode blog for the New York Times. She sat down with Virginia to talk about how changing laws and perceptions around marijuana are challenging today's parents.
So for a long time, the conversation around marijuana was a pretty short one. Just say no. Is this abbreviated approach useful for parents today?
You know, I don't think that anything quite so simple is going to work anymore. Teenagers know that marijuana is legal in some places, but many people argue that it's safer than alcohol. They can get to it more easily, and I think we're just going to have, at the very least, a longer version of that conversation.
So what are some of the different ways that parents are handling this issue now?
Well, I mean, parents are handling it in ways across the board. A colleague of mine wrote a neat recent article about, you know, five families who ranged from, lighting the joints and baking the nachos, literally, to taking the doors off of a child's room who had been found with some marijuana and taking all his drawers and sort of really coming down hard. So there are, there's a range, and there's going to be a range depending on where you are and what children can get to easily. It's going to be a huge variety of approaches for a while.
Well, I think a lot of us, grew up with the parent who was, we heard, smoked pot with their kids, and of course the others who were super, super strict. So do you have a sense whether this spectrum of how parents are dealing with pot is different than it was a decade or two ago, or is it just more open now that the public perception and visibility of marijuana has changed?
You know, I suppose that the on the extreme ends, it's probably not that different. But what's really changing is the approach of those of us in the middle. Maybe we're not sure ourselves how we feel about legalization. Maybe we used marijuana ourselves as teenagers or as young adults. Maybe we still do. And maybe we live somewhere where we can do that legally, and maybe we don't.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many variables right now. It's actually kind of fascinating. I mean, there's how you're going to talk to your own kids about it. Then there's what you do if your neighbors are regular and legal marijuana users. Is that something you need to have a conversation with your kid about? Is that something you need to have a conversation with them about, depending on how old your kid is? It's really a whole new and kind of fascinating world.
Yeah, that's what's so fascinating to me, that it's going to be more acceptable as more states legalize marijuana, and that's kind of where trends are going. That at the family barbecue, rather than the neighbor or Uncle George, pulling out a beer, he might light up or vape or something
all
like
true,
that.
All true, in Boulder at least, if not necessarily in Cleveland.
Right, exactly. But, how should parents respond to pot used by other parents if they are using it legally? It's kind of awkward.
It really is, and we're at this moment where right now, I think even in Boulder, jaws might still drop just a little bit at most barbecues. 10 years from now, who knows? New York City just declared that they aren't going to make arrests for people carrying around an ounce. That's sort of a de facto legalization of, again, possession but not sale. So it's changing in some places and not in others. It's really kind of wild. But one thing that's really important to remember and to emphasize is this is not legal for teenagers anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is the research telling us about pot use and effects on kids?
Well, the research is in flux as well. Some researchers are going to argue that regular and consistent pot use, at least, has really been shown to affect a growing brain. It affects memory it affects ability to make good, good decision making. I think that's your frontal cortex. So there's some evidence about that with respect to regular use. There's not a lot of evidence about, the effects of casual use. There's also evidence that regular marijuana use is associated with lower grades and less life satisfaction and less happiness. But, again, that's the usual correlation causation problem. And really, there's not a hard and fast line to hold on that.
But parents may still want to take a zero-tolerance approach for kids.
Well, it is still illegal. And, listen to some of the consequences of a marijuana conviction. That's going to rule you out. You're not going to be able to travel to many countries. Casual marijuana use, if you admit to it, still is going to rule you out for jobs with anything from the FBI to the fire department to the police department to, maybe your White House internship. What teenagers decide now about pot can affect their lives later. There are colleges, universities, and employers who will take social media evidence of pot use pretty seriously. It's really something to consider whether you end up with a conviction or not.
Well, it's adding to the complication, of course, is that in places where the law has changed to allow recreational or medicinal marijuana, weed doesn't look like it used to, edibles and vapors. Is that going to change the way that parents need to think about marijuana?
I think it should, and I think it should change it in two ways. First of all, when your kids are young, it seems to me that it would be a lot easier for a relatively young child to accept a piece of marijuana chocolate from a friend or from anyone than it would be to hand them over, a lit joint. That's a little different. And even with teenagers, it's more of a stretch to take something and smoke it or vape it or use a pen than it is to eat it. Eating is a familiar and easy activity, and candy is appealing. And those marijuana chocolate bars, heck, they look good.
Do you think, KJ, there are any advantages to having a more permissive policy on pot, even if only for kids who are 18 or older?
I have such mixed feelings about this. I am actually a former New York City prosecutor, and I would agree that much of the drug prosecution that we did, especially around marijuana, was ridiculous and time-consuming and expensive for society. On the other hand, now, as a parent, I see that legalizing marijuana is going to make it easier to get. I have read and understand the arguments about it being safe, but I'm not sure whether I'm fully on board with that. It's a complicated topic.
I imagine if your kids were teenagers and one of them came home with evidence of pot, the conversation would be altogether out of the theoretical realm.
It would be, and you know what? It will be. I have four kids.
Right.
Statistically, one of them is going to, if not more than one, is going to give this a shot. And it is a little hard to say theoretically what you're going to say. You do need to be ready. And one of my favorite things that I have heard is the importance of having a conversation, not a lecture.
Mm-hmm.
Talk with your kids about beforehand, if you can, why they might try it, why they might be tempted to try it, even if they think now that they wouldn't, why people do try white marijuana and why they use it. And then after, if you have found that your child is using or has given it a try, talk about why they made that choice before you start yelling about what's going to happen as a result.
So, best way to approach those conversations, KJ, any advice?
I think that the question is where to start. And the answer that I have heard is every opportunity that you can. If you're a parent and you're listening to this in your car right now, as happens to me a lot, now's a great time to bring this up, no matter how old your kids are. If they're young, do they know what marijuana is? Have they seen it? If they're in the middle grades or early teen years, have they seen it? Have they seen any friends using it? Have any of their friends talked about using it? Have they seen it used in movies or in cartoons? What are they seeing? What do they know? And if they're teenagers, what are they seeing? Their friends, and that can be, quote, friends or not. What are they seeing going on? Try to get them to have a conversation with you. And, boy, when they're in the back seat and you're in the front, or they're in the passenger seat and you're next to them, that is the best time.
Well, what about for parents who use, which is becoming more and more common?
Parents who are regular users for medical reasons or for recreational users should be honest with their kids about you know, what they're doing in the same way that you would be about alcohol, I think. And I think it's actually probably a very similar conversation. It's just that we're not ready as a society to have it that way.
KJ Dell'Antonia, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
KJ Dell'Antonia blogs about family for the New York Times. You can find links to her many articles and contributions on parenting in the age of legalized marijuana at wordofmouthradio.org.
Look, Dad, it's not
Where did you get it?
Dad,
answer me. Who taught you how to do this stuff?
You, all right? I learned it by watching you.
And we stick with the parenting beat to examine a growing issue for some working parents, the Forever Clock. A look at the latest in around-the-clock service, 24-hour daycare. That's when Word of Mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. First, there were all-night diners and gas stations, which are now mainstays. Then came the 24-hour supermarkets, urgent care centers, and big box stores open for the holidays. Our economies and societies now run on the forever clock. So, as we head into yet another holiday shopping season, let's consider not only who's working during the wee hours, but who is taking care of their kids. Author and producer Alyssa Quart wrote about the rise of 24-hour daycare facilities for Pacific Standard Magazine and spoke to Virginia about the new phenomenon.
Now, you visited Dee's Tots. This is in New Rochelle, New York. 24-hour, 7-day-a-week daycare center. Do we have any kind of accurate count on how many of these overnight daycare centers there are now?
You know, I was looking for that number, and I couldn't find it. I could find it anecdotally, which is calling around and looking online at the number, and they appear to be growing exponentially. And that makes sense, because nearly 40% of Americans have non-standard work lives, which means they're working not only at night, but early in the morning and erratically, you know. So sometimes they won't be working in the middle of the afternoon when it was normal for people to work, or they might be working on weekends. So these daycares have risen up in response to that.
So that's the general need for overnight daycare, these kind of non-traditional work hours. Any specifics, any people that you met there who were trying to balance this non-traditional work life with daycare?
Yeah, so I met people, parents who worked at big box stores where they were asked to work at night, at Costco and Home Depot, but also nurses or nurses' aides who were working evening shifts or even weekend shifts. And one worker in particular works from 9 to around 2:30 in the morning and into the afternoon, and then picks up her kids and hangs out with them, and then drops them off again at 5:30 and works until the evening. So there's basically two shifts that she has them in the daycare, and then she doesn't see them again until 10:30 at night. That is not untypical for these centers.
So she picks up her kids at 10:30 at night, but there are some who have to pick up their kids at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, I mean, Pat and Dolores had to be willing and able to wake up in the middle of the night like parents do after having worked these incredibly long hours with the kids in their house. And they're not young. I mean, they're in their 50s, late 50s, so this is a lot for them.
Pat and Dolores Hogan is the couple who run Dee's Tots. But, you know, it seems to me hearing about this, you know, picking up a kid at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, bringing them in very, very early in the morning, especially to people who don't have these kind of needs, anecdotally, they think, oh, it's awful. You know, how can that be? It's so disruptive. What kind of reactions did you get?
Yeah, I mean, I send my daughter to daycare where, you know, she could be in there 8 hours a day, and some of the other kids are there nine and a half hours. But, you know, when I brought it up with parent friends and acquaintances, often who weren't even sending their kids to daycare, sent their kids, you know, had their kids with a nanny or an au pair or something, they'd be startled. They'd be like, how could this be? It sounds horrible, you know. And I just, there's a gap in our understanding. I mean, we think that, okay, we're going to go pick up groceries at 2 in the morning or at midnight or even at 9 and in the evening, and we're not thinking, well, the person doing the checkout has to put their kids somewhere. And so I wanted to try to connect our understanding of this whole system of non-traditional labor and shift work stretching into the evening with what happens to children in the daycare needs that they now have. Mm-hmm. And I think the shock is that people just don't make those connections.
Well, Dolores and Pat, as we mentioned, they work on Thanksgiving when stores and nurses and chambermaids still have to work. I'm wondering if it's affordable. I can only imagine that working a low-wage job would just cover the cost of daycare.
Well, Dolores and Pat have a lot of state subsidies, you know, available to the parents. So many of the parents there are getting much of their daycare covered, and that's how they're able to pay for this, which is one of the reasons that the middle class is often in such bad position with this, because if you are not, a well-paid doctor who's working long hours, but let's say you are a nurse, old-fashioned, lower-middle-class profession, and you don't qualify for subsidies, then you are paying a lot.
It's hard for any parent to imagine having a slumber party, you know, a room full of kids every single night. How many kids and how did the Hogans actually manage it?
Well, when I went there, you know, the kids, there was probably six around in the evening, roughly. And then overnight, you know, there's four until 10:30, and then there was just two overnight. So the numbers weren't shocking, but I'm sure in some of these centers they can be larger than that. And it's just like any other slumber party is the word for it. I mean, I had to keep reminding myself not to try to take care of these kids like I would with my own three-year-old, you know, because they're getting their teeth brushed. And, you know, Dolores is this pillar and she's like running around trying to do all this. But, you know, and Pat is too. But, you know, I was like, one of them's going to have a meltdown. and it's just like it would be with my three-year-old if she had, you know, four of her friends over.
Watching the kids, though, any sense, any observation on your part that they're aware that this is weird, or are they just being kids and being adaptive?
Well, there's two things here. In a way, it's less weird than if they were doing their other option, which would be informal daycare network.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that would be extended family, neighbors, you know, people on the block, whatever, doing this kind of daycare, and sometimes there'll be strangers coming in and out in that environment, and it's even less predictable than the Hogans or daycare centers like the Hogans. So I actually think that this kind of 24-hour daycare is preferable, or in some cases, to the informal networks, because we don't really know what you're getting with them. By that same token, you know, I saw ripples of uncertainty amongst the kids at night, and one of them said to me, thinking parents are going to save you. Why did the characters in this film we were watching think that? And, you know, and they were learning how to brush their teeth. And the little one, I think she was like three or four, and she was perfectly able to put the toothpaste on the toothbrush. And I thought to myself, my three-year-old will not be able to do this in a year. I mean, this is a kid who's used to taking care of herself, which, again, I don't want to just turn that into a tragedy because it cuts both ways. I mean, as I put it, it means she's parentified or able to parent herself, right, which has a certain sadness to it. But then it's also like she's resilient. You know, she'll probably be able to, you know, do things like put her toothpaste on her toothbrush when she's older that other kids who are being more coddled or, you know, more constantly cared for won't be able to.
Well, it does in a way recall a time or a situation where extended families do take care of kids and maybe, you know, cousins of varying ages would be thrown together. But you point out that especially in low-income families, these kind of extended networks do get strained. What do you mean by that?
Extended networks get strained by poverty. I mean, if you're a woman, let's say there were studies done, a single mother, you're going to be 30% more likely to rely on your extended families and your, you know, friends and so forth for help, which tightens community, right? I mean, I look at my own daycare practices, and I'm not leaning on my neighbors or anything like that, right? And I may not know some of them, right, as a result. But if you are depending on your family and your neighbors and your friends like that, there's just going to become a breaking point where they're just not going to be able to do it anymore. They'll just say, hey, I have my own kid, or, you know, I have no money to make dinner for your kid every night or what have you. So I think that's part of where the 24-hour daycare centers come in. I mean, and even when I was at this particular daycare center, there were non-parents doing drop-offs, right? So even with these extended hours, sometimes they'd need an aunt or a cousin to do drop-offs for kids.
Well, Lisa, it doesn't seem like our job landscape is going to change that much or that radically. Are we going to see a lot more of these kind of 24-hour or overnight daycare centers in the future?
Yeah, we're going to see more of these daycare centers in the future. And I actually loved what you guys were just saying in the lead into this show, which was, you know, yeah, you have all-night diners and all-night stores, and now you're having all-night daycare. And it's part of what I called the forever clock, which is the sense that, you know, we never stop working now, and we never stop shopping, and we never stop doing, and never start eating, right? And so we're going to have daycare for the workers who are supporting this forever economy.
Alyssa Quart, author of several books, including Republic of Outsiders, co-editor of the nonprofit Economic Hardship Reporting Project, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Word of Mouth continues with a historical look at the legalization of another drug, alcohol. How prohibition changed bluegrass music. That story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. When it comes to taking sides on moral issues, bluegrass picks its battles. In the early 1900s, old-time string bands would often address the subject of booze, and while some songs would warn against the evils of strong drink, many others would celebrate it. And then came Prohibition. This story comes to us from the radio show Gems of Bluegrass and host Philip Nussbaum.
Rye whiskey, rye whiskey, rye whiskey, I cry. If I don't get rye whiskey, I surely will die.
Yeah, we can't have all this fuss around here. We're going to make this liquor while let's make it and get through with it, Riley. You go up there on the hill and bring that thumper keg down here and bring that rye paste with you.
All right.
And, Gid, you go up there and cut some of them hickory poles and get some green ones now that won't make no smoke.
All right.
And, Lowe, you go down at the gap, bring that condenser up here. Hurry back with it now.
All
Fate,
right.
While they're doing that, you fix that swab stick, and if you'll hurry up and get it fixed, I'll give you a little snort.
Good.
All right, let's have a little tune now, Fate.
The Skillet Liquors and a little skit about a subject that delighted rural audiences during Prohibition, making illegal moonshine. There are loads of songs with titles like Prohibition is a Failure and Down to the Stillhouse to Get a Little Cider, which celebrate the joys of illegal alcohol. But then Prohibition ended, and the only alcohol-related songs were ones that argued against it.
Who did you say it was, brother? Who was it fell by the way? When whiskey and blood run together, did you hear anyone pray? I didn't hear nobody pray, dear brother. I didn't hear nobody pray. I heard the crash on the highway, but I didn't hear nobody pray.
When it comes to the view of alcohol and drinking in bluegrass, Wreck on the Highway just about says it all. The equation is, if you drink, extremely bad things happen to you. Now, most people today agree that bad things can happen with alcohol. It's just that in bluegrass songs, there's no middle ground between alcoholism and abstinence.
This old smoke field bar is something I'm not used to. But I gave up my home to see you satisfied. And I just called to let you know where I'd be living. It's not much, but I feel welcome here inside. And I've got swinging doors, a jukebox, and a bar stool. New home has a flashing neon sign. Still Drop by and see me anytime you want to, because I'm always here at home till closing time.
The Lost and Found doing Merle Haggard. The singer says he feels welcome in his honky-tonk of choice. Actually, it's his girlfriend's honky-tonk of choice. He gave up everything to be with her, but you can tell the guy realizes he's made a wrong turn. And we listeners think so, too.
I got everything I need to drive me crazy. And I got everything it takes to lose my mind. And in here, the atmosphere is just right for a party. And thanks to you, I'm always here till closing time.
Where does the critique of honky-tonk culture and booze come from? It isn't from pop. Yeah, there always have been forces preaching abstinence from alcohol in pop culture. But a generation ago in pop culture, drinking alcohol didn't receive the level of disdain it receives today. Back then, there was a lot of lighthearted humor about getting drunk, and then a certain cool surrounding celebrities who always seemed a little tipsy, like Dean Martin. Plus, all the pop songs about booze, like the R&B hit One Mint Julep.
One early morning, as I was walking,
then there was drinking wine, spodiote, scotch and soda, gimme that wine, but not in bluegrass. In bluegrass, you get drink up and go home. Also in bluegrass, there's a subgenre of songs about women who are lost souls because they hang out in honky-tonks.
Them lights, they smoke and loud, loud music is the only kind of life you'll ever understand. Them lights, thick smoke, and loud, loud music. You'll never make a wife to a home-loving man.
Bluegrass has a consistent point of view regarding alcohol, and it is anti. Why? Well, this point of view has always been with us. Once Prohibition ended, the complaints about government interference went away. It made the long shadow of strict religious principles that are part of the background of bluegrass music seem more prominent. You hear this influence in the gospel songs that are such a big part of bluegrass. But it's funny how the music has picked certain moral issues to advocate. For example, a high percentage of bluegrass songs are about falling out of love, yet the music does not advocate maintaining marriage at all costs. But as far as booze, in bluegrass songs, there is a no-tolerance policy and no cheers bar where you go for friendship. Instead, the music paints a picture of a downward spiral of gloom.
It's a honky-tonk blues I'm trying to lose. It's a honky-tonk blues that's wearing out the soles of my shoes.
For Gems of Bluegrass, this is Phil Nussbaum.
Feeling colder every day, but don't put your binoculars away just yet. When we return, we'll talk about some of the brave birds that don't mind hunkering down through a New Hampshire winter. From the American tree sparrow to the snowy owl, word of mouth puts a bird on it after the break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Birds in New England are most commonly associated with spring, but as birdwatcher Eric Masterson explains, there are plenty of species that brave the winter weather and live here year-round. Eric is land protection specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education and author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. That's a hyper-local guide to the best birding spots and events the state has to offer. Eric, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
So it is starting to feel a little more like winter every day. You know, temperatures are dropping. Many parts of the region have had their first dusting of snow. So before we touch on the species that do stick around, is it too late to catch any birds that have yet to migrate?
It's kind of on the tail end of it, yeah. I live in the Monadnock region, so we have winter come a little bit earlier to us. We had a little bit more than a dusting. So that clears the birds out. And so the ones that are left are ones that can survive in a, you know, freshwater birds don't do well when the water freezes. And so if they can transition to a marine environment, so any birds that can live out their life on the salt water do well. So like common loons, they head to the salt water. So you'll see them in New Hampshire off the coast, but not inland. Seed eaters, so birds that can feed on mast that has fallen to the forest floor, like grouse and turkeys, sparrows. And then scavengers, you know, the birds that do well around humans, like starlings and sparrows, they stay around. But insect eaters, birds that rely on fresh water, not so good. If you're a kingfisher trying to dive into a pond to catch fish and it's frozen, not so good for
you. Yeah, you're going to get a lot thinner.
Yeah.
So how come if there are so many birds that do reside in the state year-round, how come we don't hear them as much? It seems like birdsong is something associated so much with springtime, you know, that the whole air erupts with birdsong. But in the winter, I feel like I don't hear it as much. But maybe
well, you do know, you're absolutely right. So birds, so you just take a cardinal, for instance, and a cardinal has a number of different call notes that it uses, and then it has a song. And songs are just used in the summer to attract a mate and defend a territory. And if you're not doing that, you don't want to advertise your presence to predators. So they leave out the songs in the winter, pretty much. You can occasionally hear songs in the winter, but pretty much they're left out. And they just use call notes to keep in touch with each other or to sound an alarm, like a chickadee-dee-dee-dee, the chickadee's alarm call. That the number of D's in the chickadee-dee-dee is a function of how high the threat level is. So they'll use those, but they won't sing because they just don't want to attract predators.
So 4 or 5 D's is like
not good.
The red alert.
Yeah, right.
So this is a very strange question. You mentioned the different things that winter birds are able to eat, seeds especially, you mentioned. We were talking back in our pod, we were talking about when we've seen birds that are eating trash. You know, this is something that sometimes I've seen in the winter times where birds seem to be basically dumpster diving. Mm-hmm. And we were wondering, now, is that a very bad thing? And what is that doing?
Well, it was, when I think of dumpsters, I think of landfills. And landfills are a disappearing feature of our landscape. There used to be a lot more. So, for instance, if you went back 20 years, there were thousands of gulls in the Keene area because Keene had a landfill. It doesn't anymore. The trash outside of landfills, clearly trash. You know, if you go to a cafe and have a scone, you'll see the little sparrows, English sparrows, down around the table picking up crumbs. It's not bad for them. I mean, if there's a a place where a lot of birds congregate, like a landfill, it can be a place where disease is transmitted more easily because there's a lot of birds in close proximity. So you do get outbreaks of things like botulism in communities where there's a lot of birds. But no, in general, no. But they're disappearing anyway. So landfills, which are the big dumpsters, they're going. There's only a few left in the state.
Okay, well, let's get back to which birds are still around in the winter. So any rare birds specifically that we should be keeping an eye on this time of year?
Well, last winter, folks may remember, we had this incredible once-in-a-hundred-year invasion of snowy owls because there was a very successful breeding season for lemmings in the Arctic, which in turn supported a very successful year for snowy owls. And so there is probably still more snowy owls. That massive peak in the population probably hasn't returned entirely to normal, and there's probably going to be an elevated number of snowies this year. Some years they're quite scarce, so I expect there'll be a good year. I've already seen one, and there's been a couple around the state.
Where did you see it?
Out on Star Island.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that was sort of the prime breeding ground before?
No, they don't breed anywhere close to here. They don't breed south of there. They breed north of the tree line, so way up in Arctic tundra, in the tundra in Canada. So nowhere closer than Quebec, northern Quebec. But they winter here in you know, regularly, but in very fluctuating numbers, as we've seen.
And aside from the owls, do any birds migrate specifically to the region for the wintertime?
Oh, totally, yeah. So there's a sparrow. A lot of our sparrows, so even though sparrows eat seed, even seed eaters find it tough going in the winter, and they pretty much, they're still here, but their numbers are reduced. So a lot of sparrows can be scarce in the winter. But there's one species that comes in exclusively for the winter called the American tree sparrow. And it breeds, again, north of us in Canada. and is quite common in the winter. And they've just started arriving in the last couple of weeks, so they're a late migrant.
I've always imagined bird watching to be an activity that requires a great deal of patience. You know, sometimes a lot of sitting around, I would think, you know, waiting for the moment to happen. Does the cold weather make it harder for those like yourself who are especially looking for those rare sightings?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I am. Cold, and especially, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the birds congregate at the coast because it's where the water remains open, and cold is even colder when you throw in wind coming in off the ocean. So it can be really bitter, yeah. So I'm waiting for the perfect car to be developed that has glass windshield that's flat so it doesn't cause spherical problems when you look through. If you look through a regular car windshield with binoculars, everything's distorted. So I want the perfect car that has a sunroof, a flat windshield, so you don't have to get out of your car and brave the elements.
Well, I'll let you know if I see one.
Right.
As a birder, is a large part of the thrill seeing something rare, or do you appreciate all birds, regardless of how common they may be? Like, do you still get a kick when you catch a glimpse of a wild turkey or, you know, a city pigeon?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I liken bird watching from a cultural perspective to it's a very large tent. And in that tent, there are people who enjoy birds on so many different levels. And there are listers. You know, there was this movie last year, I think it was last year or the year before, The Big Year, which described one particular subculture of birding. There are people who just are interested in hawk watching. I see them every year for a couple of days up on Pachmannadnock hawk watching, and I won't see him for the rest of the year. There are other people who are just interested in gulls. So there's a lot of subcultures within this big tent. So it's really kind of fascinating. The people who the practitioners of birdwatching are kind of a fascinating group of people. I myself kind of eschew rare bird chasing and listing. I'm not really interested in that.
And listing, is that when you're sort of counting the number of bird sightings? So it's almost like a sport.
It is totally a sport. And it sometimes I think that there's less, that folks, that listing subculture has more in common with stamp collecting or train spotting than it does with some other bird watchers who might be, you know, take more of a scientific or a conservationist bent. Nothing wrong with it. It's not a subjective comment. It's just it is a subjective comment. But
but I suppose for you, you know, as somebody who might be interested in seeing any bird, it is about the biology and the miracle of nature.
I mean, for me, I remember the last moment I that really stopped me in my tracks. I was on a boat out in the Gulf of Maine, and a flock of 50 American golden plovers flew over. And we were about 80 miles out to sea, and I know the biology of this species. It breeds across the Arctic tundra in Canada from Alaska east to Hudson Bay. And the entire population, with a few straggle down the coast, but the majority of the population leaves the North American continent from the Maritimes and flies out over the Atlantic nonstop to South America.
Wow.
And so I saw them 80 miles out to sea. I took a bearing on the direction they were going, and I knew I saw them come into my field of view from the left, travel across maybe for 30 seconds, and they were gone. I would never see them again. And I knew that they were in the midst of this multi-day migration. And that's just, for me, that's what it's about. It's just an awe-inspiring miracle.
Well, for anybody interested in getting into bird watching this coming winter, any recommendations? You mentioned Star Island. Is that a really good place to start?
Star Island's always terrific because the coast is always terrific. Coast tends to be a collecting point. Birds, a lot of species of birds avoid, unless they're clearly marine species, a lot of species of birds avoid open water. And so they tend to collect at the coast. It's like a collecting point. And so you can get higher concentrations, and then you can get odd species mixed in the mix. Higher concentrations of common birds and higher concentrations of rare birds. So coast is a good place, and Star Island is my favorite place on the coast. I go out there a lot. It's not great at this time of year because we're really, you know, there are very few birds around relative to the summer. It's much better in spring and fall. But the coast is a good time. The water still hasn't frozen yet. So a lot of the open lakes, a lot of the lakes are still, I'd say most of the lakes are still open, and waterfowl will be pushed out of the rivers into the larger lakes where they'll roost. And so you can get migrant species and local species congregating on lakes this time of year, and you can get some neat species.
Eric Masterson is Land Protection Specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education and author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. Eric, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.
The sport of birding relies on more than just a keen sense of sight. For many enthusiasts, it's the sound of a bird that helps to identify a rare species. From the Encyclopedia of Life, Ari Daniel Shapiro brings us this story of a professor whose ears are just as valuable as his eyes.
Well, I'm going to take you out to show you a few of our nice local native birds, and to listen to them particularly. We'll go across the street here, I think.
Peter Slater was professor of natural history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland.
Professor of natural history is a lovely old Scottish title.
He retired a couple years back, but almost 10 years ago, Peter was my advisor for my master's degree. And when I was in Scotland recently, I took him up on his offer to go on a local bird walk. We started right on Peter's doorstep.
I take my dog for a walk every morning in St. Andrews, and I count all the birds that I see or hear. And I usually get up to 20 or 30 different sorts of bird. Actually, quite a few of those I hardly ever see, but because I've been studying birdsong for many years, I can actually recognize them by their voice.
Why do you keep track of the birds like that?
For fun. For fun. It's quite... there's a joy in being able to recognize the different sounds that they produce. Now, we're going to get run over here, I think, so we've got to be a bit careful.
We made our way along a few streets before arriving on a wide pedestrian walkway lined with trees.
There's a chaffinch singing somewhere around here. That's him there.
What do chaffinches look like?
They're a sort of reddy orange breast and a grayish head and a sort of russet brown back. That's a male, and they have two white wing bars, and so they're quite striking. The female, is, as in many species, is much more dowdy. There he is. Isn't he lovely? I love chaffinches, my favourite bird. And his female will probably be sitting on eggs. And he's singing away in the treetops there, keeping other males out of the territory. He doesn't sit on the eggs, but he does help her feed the chicks. So when the eggs hatch, he will stop singing and he will start bombing to and fro, collecting caterpillars and insects and things and stuffing them into the beaks of the chicks. But at the moment, his main task, I think, is to keep the territory free of other chaffinches so that when the eggs hatch, that territory is theirs and theirs alone. And all the food on it that's suitable for chaffinches is there for him, for his female, and for their chicks in the nest.
And what's going on in the song here?
It consists of a trill of little notes like that. But at the end of it, wheep, did you hear at the end, there's a thing called a flourish. The trill consists of different sorts of notes. It'll sing A-A-A-A-A, B-B-B-B-B, C-C-C-C-C, and then it'll sing D, which is the make the flourish at the end. So birdsong is usually used, one, to attract females, the other, to keep rivals out. And they use the same song for both those reasons.
It seems like kind of listening for and looking out for birds in your neighborhood is something that a lot of people can do, even if they live in a rather settled area.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, an awful lot of birds live in towns and cities. Birds are attracted to human habitations and gardens. I don't know, I should think you could hear at the moment about 10 or 15 different species of birds singing in St. Andrews, in this little area here. It's certainly something you can do bang in the middle of cities, no problem. And it's rather charming. Listen to that, just as we walk in the Botanic Garden, a wren. That's the same as your wren, it's a winter wren. They're small and brown and speckledy, and they have a tiny little upturned tail, and they eat insects. Wren song has about the highest rate of production of notes of any bird song. I can't remember how it is. It's 30 or 40 different notes in 1 second. I mean, they really come very, very thick and fast. Hear the wren there? Isn't that beautiful? The most extraordinary little bird, you know, an incredibly varied song it produces at a fantastic rate and produces a huge volume of sound out of this tiny, tiny little body.
What are the species, the genus and species for the chaffinch and the wren?
The chaffinch is Fringilla.
Fringilla
coelebs.
Coelebs.
Coelebs. And the wren is Troglodytes troglodytes. There it is. I mean, it is so difficult to describe sounds verbally. I think it's right, like describing wine or something like that. You know, you get these people who are extraordinarily expert at using particular phrases to describe the taste of a white wine or something. And it's like these sort of sounds. How do you describe that? What words can you use? It defies description in many ways.
You have to hear it.
You have to hear it, really.
Well, Well, that does it for today's show. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. And if you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. While you're there, you can check out photos and sounds of some of the birds that winter in New England. And who knows, maybe that'll inspire you to bust out the binoculars and get into the sport of birdwatching yourself. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.